Hi, friends. I'm Kara Kay, and this is the Asking for a Friend podcast, a show for the woman who has questions about herself, the church, and the world. We are all asking hard questions that affect us as women in the culture that surrounds us, and we are looking for a safe place to ask them. But don't worry, I know you're only asking for a friend. All right, friends, welcome to another episode of Asking for a Friend. I have my friend Chandra here today, and I'm so excited to talk. She had a book come out recently called Mixed Blessing, and this book has been a blessing to me. I've been reading through it. I was just sharing with her before we hopped on the call that I haven't recorded in about 6 weeks because I've been recovering from a really bad case of COVID. So if you guys listening, if you follow me on social media, I've been sharing a bit about it, but it has been quite a journey. And so I apologize if I sound terrible. I feel like my the octave of my voice went down a few levels. I am like my voice was super deep, and my son was like, he was laughing at me because I sounded like Batman, and he always does like that deep Batman voice. I was like, I do. I sound like Batman. It's great. So welcome to the show. Thank you for taking the time to sit down with me after we've rescheduled about 10 times, I think.
Absolutely. No worries. It's great to be here. And I love say, having you. Get your Etta James on. That's great. Get that, that low, so throaty voice.
That is right. That is right. So tell me a bit about your story. Where this book came from, what led you to this journey of wanting to share this part of your story with the world?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So I first read a book called Check All That Apply about 2005, and that was written by a woman who is Black, white, biracial, Sundi Fraser, and she wrote it because the 2000 census was the first census where you could check all that apply, where you didn't have to choose one ethnicity over another. Right. So I read this book and it blew my mind. It was the first time that I'd heard two things really clearly said. One, that it would not be better if I had been monoethnic, that actually it was a part of God's plan and was a good thing that I have the ethnic story, the cultural story that I have. And two, that Jesus himself was mixed, was multi-ethnic. And those two things just blew me away.
Yeah, I had never heard that until I was reading your book, that Jesus was multicultural, that Jesus was multi-ethnic. And I was like, oh my goodness. Right? Why have I never thought about this before?
Right. And it changes everything.
Yeah, it does. It does.
So I read that book. It amazed me. It inspired me, encouraged me. I bought a bunch of copies and gave them away to people that either are mixed or have mixed families. And then it went out of print. And so because I work for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, I have friends at InterVarsity Press. And so I started lovingly harassing them and saying, hey, why is this out of print? And what can we do? And can I help? And what can we do to get back in print? And finally they responded directly. You know, usually it was I'm glad you like it. Sorry, you know.
Right.
but eventually they said, okay, Chandra, here's the deal. First of all, Sundi is writing children's literature now, which she has several really great, especially early chapter books that she's written about being mixed and about the mixed experience. Secondly, we really need the book for the next generation. This book was in some ways ahead of its time, and now we need something that addresses transracial adoption, that addresses just, 20 years later, the culture and the way things are. And so I started harassing them, saying, well, who can write it? Who can write it? And finally, one of my coworkers turned to me one day during these conversations and said, well, why don't you write it? Which is beautiful and terrifying and ridiculous. And so I started thinking, oh, okay, what if I did write it? And so thankfully the Lord is really gracious. My friend at InterVarsity Press, turned out to be my editor, Al Shee. And so we started talking about what that could look like. And during some of my most doubting moments, some of my most I don't know what I'm doing. I'm in over my head. This is my first book. My family needs me. Do I even have the right to do this moments? He and Sundi, I actually got to interview Sundi, which was, you know, a lot of squealing fangirlness and trying to, you know, be professional. He and Sundi both have said more than once, you are the person for this book. This is the time for this book. The Lord has called you to this place. And so that's the kind of thing you definitely hold on to during those moments of doubt. And so it was really sweet to be able to tell my story, to be able to interview several people and to have the honor of sharing some of their stories. I've always wanted to write a book. I've always loved books. I've always loved literature. And so it is definitely a dream come true to write this book, even as it's been really hard and a lot.
Oh, for sure. But yeah, it is a lot. Oh, well, it is definitely needed. There are some things that really stood out to me that I'd love to chat through. I want to speak to my listeners who are in that place that are like, where do I fit? You know, the people that are getting the questions, okay, what are you? That you mentioned that you kept getting that question. What are you? So I want to speak to them first, and then I want to shift in a minute, but talk to me about that. Have you always felt this pull? Like, okay, I need a place to belong. I have to choose a side. I have to pick. What does that look like for you growing up and finding your identity and who you, in your culture, in your background? What does that look like?
Yeah. So it's been a really winding path because in addition to being multi-ethnic, I'm also multicultural. So my birth father was a Thai citizen. My mom is a white American. Things didn't work out between them. And so I never met him. She was a single mom. Shout out to single parents for the first 5 years of my life. And then she remarried. And the man she married, the man who was my stepdad, the man who adopted me, the man who became my dad, was Black. And so I have this experience of never quite fitting in a lot of different places. I also was born and raised in New Mexico, which is itself that mestizo state of a fusion between, you know, Hispanic is the preferred term, or Chicano, Chicana, between Mexican immigrants or Mexicans who were there when the border crossed them, and Native peoples, between those who were colonizing and those who were colonized. And so in some ways I've never quite fit in anywhere, but I've also been surrounded by a lot of people who also don't quite fit in. And so there's been kind of a solidarity there. Most days now, especially, I consider it a blessing to be mixed. I consider it a good thing. I'm really grateful, especially after doing all the research and the interviews, to be reminded, oh, okay, this is a good thing. This has made me the empathetic person I am. This has given me the perspective that I have. This has helped me to see the kingdom in the way I do. But yeah, it can be really wearying not fitting in. And there's definitely a sense of, okay, well, I mentioned in the book, when you get asked, what are you, often enough, you start to wonder too. What am I then? If nobody can tell, and I don't even know, because I don't quite fit in, even in my family, I definitely don't fit in society. I'm this oddball. Yeah, you start to really wonder. And because I wasn't a believer until college, in some ways, I didn't have that healthy basis of identity in Christ. But, and I think I'm just now realizing this and unpacking this, even in this conversation with you, I also didn't have the trip up of evangelical white culture, which wanted to train me in colorblindness.
Right.
So there is a sense in which I'm thinking, oh, that's interesting that even the Lord did that, where my wrestling with my identity did happen in a secular way that maybe it couldn't have in white evangelical culture. But there definitely is that sense of, how do I fit? Who am I? How do I wrestle and appreciate who I am? And definitely a sense of sometimes colorblindness feels easier.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much where I was by high school, was right. this kind of hip colorblindness. One of my best friends in high school, who is also himself mixed, white Latino, he used to say my family was like a United Colors of Benetton ad. Right. Because before Target and I don't know, are we allowed to say all these names? Is this a
sure,
problem?
For sure.
I mean, you know, there's whole discussions of like, if I want to give them airtime at all, but before all of these popular Old Navy and Target, before all of them right. figured out that mixed is hot.
Yeah.
United Colors of Benetton was definitely doing it.
Yeah. Right?
And had that diversity. And so, yeah, he would say your family's like a walking United Colors of Benetton ad. And we would laugh.
Right.
Yeah. So just this sense of, ooh, I just really don't fit in anywhere. And what does that mean yeah. about me? And at my worst, a sense of real despair about that. But I think at my best, a sense of, oh, okay, I get to decide who I am.
Yeah.
Which yeah, I think is actually good. Very freeing.
So what is your response? I feel like I hear two camps on this. You touched on finding your identity in Christ. So I hear some people will say, you know, don't find your identity in your ethnicity, in your culture, in that, in your race, but find your identity in Christ alone. And so I feel like some people will push aside their upbringing, their backgrounds, all of those things and say, well, my identity is only in Christ. But let me read this quote that I marked in the book because this just really stood out to me. It says, being in Christ doesn't mean losing our humanity and distinctiveness. It means reclaiming it. Christ was the earthly embodiment of the wholeness of the fruit of the Spirit, fulfiller of both the letter and the spirit of the law. I love that. That just like stood out to me so much in finding your identity in Christ, but also in your humanity. What is your response to that? How do
you? Yeah. So I think that the narrative that Satan wants to present is that you have to choose one or the other. Right. Mm-hmm. And right. so I think that's what he pushes. And so I think a lot of folks, especially in the white church, will say, yeah, identity in Christ, don't get caught up mm-hmm. in all this other stuff, don't lose sight right. of Jesus. And then I think on the other side, a lot of people understandably and frustratedly will say, I'm for someone who is Black, I'm Black in America, mm-hmm. that affects me. Or
for sure.
For right. someone who right now is Asian, right. I'm Asian and I'm an Asian woman and that affects me. Because of course we're recording this and talking about this right after the murders in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And so like any savvy mixed person, I refuse to choose between the two and instead offer what I think is a healthy third way. And that is that idea of what you read, which is that our identity in Christ is what both comes before and after everything else. So if we have our identity in Christ, then we can explore all of our other identities, gender, ethnicity, familial roles, sexuality, career, community member, all of those other roles that are so important in a safe, healthy way.
Yeah.
And once I think we explore those roles with our identity in Christ, we understand our identity in Christ better, right? I think it's actually a really healthy cycle of understanding Jesus, understanding ourselves, understanding Jesus. And I think part of that too comes from what we have to get away from, which is this Gnostic idea that it's all floof and no substance, mm-hmm. that it's all soul and no body. And I think that's why the embodiment of Jesus is so important, because Jesus' identity was in the Father who gave him a body.
Right.
And gave him a specific gender, a specific ethnicity, a specific location, a specific culture, a specific history, a specific face, a specific, you know, all of these things that are attached to not a soulless existence, but a body. And so I love that Jesus was embodied. And I love, as we mentioned, that that's in his lineage. And again, before I read Sunday's book, I had never considered it before. I think we talk about the lineage of Jesus a lot. And I think some people focus more on the Jewish aspect of it, which is very clearly there, you know, he is the son of David. And also David is his son mysteriously, right? David is his servant and he is the servant of David in that sense. I think some people focus more on the genealogical aspect of it, you know, how far how far from each generation, I think some people do a little more digging and realize, oh yeah, there are women in his lineage, and that's significant and that's important. I think it's so significant that Matthew chose to include these women, right? Not just the men, but the women. Yep. And then I think once you start to dig even deeper and realize the mixed heritage that either these women were not Jewish or were themselves mixed, that they brought to Jesus, then it really, in some ways, I love not only the detail that it brings up, but the bigger picture and the bigger question of who Jesus was that it brings up. That Jesus was a complex and is a complex individual, that Jesus was a brown Middle Eastern mixed man and is for all of eternity. Right? I mean, that's so powerful. I mean, he is
Wait, you mean Jesus isn't white?
Jesus isn't white, right? And not
my goodness.
I know. So, you know, now people can send in their hate mail.
That's
Jesus
right.
isn't white. And he's not even monoethnic. And that's been really freeing for me, that he's mixed. And I had a moment of panic because mixed, as I define it in the book, is within your family. So maybe one parent or one grandparent of one ethnicity and then another, whether that's within a larger racial category like Japanese and Chinese, or between those categories like Middle Eastern and Spanish. That within your family. So you grow up with this between two worlds in your family, and that affects you at a very deep level. And if in society, you also have that kind of perpetual sense of not quite fitting in because of the way the world perceives you and expects things out of you, either because you look one ethnicity or another, or because you have that ethnic ambiguity that I have. And so I had a moment of panic fairly recently of like, I'm basically saying to white brothers and sisters, you don't count as multi-ethnic, right? Yes, you have multi-ethnicity and it's important. And I think actually the evil power of white supremacy and of white privilege is chipped away at when, and I include myself in this, right? Because I do have white heritage. I do have a white mom. When we actually reject that white label and get back to, oh, I've got Irish and Russian heritage. And that's a beautiful thing that was lost. And I'd like to get back to it. I think that's actually important. But that still doesn't count as mixed by my definition, because it doesn't affect day to day. Right. Yeah. Because you can still go back to that white personality. So I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking, oh, wait a minute. All of Jesus' ancestry that makes him mixed was kind of far back in the past. Oh no. Have I like set myself up in a terrible theological conundrum? Have I just completely, proved myself a liar? And so I was praying about it and stressing out about it. And I realized, no, because it did affect Jesus every day.
Yeah, it did.
Because he chose, right, to let it affect his every day. Because he chose, right, wildly enough, because Jesus is the Word and the author and perfecter of our faith. And because God did ordain for Jesus to have this lineage since before time, Jesus chose to have in his lineage these mixed women, these mixed folks. Yeah. Right. So, okay. No, we're good, Chandra. Don't panic. Calm down, Chandra.
I did okay.
I did okay. I did my research. I didn't just, make a big fat mistake. Not that I'm perfect, but yeah, he was affected by it. And you can see it in the way that he interacted with, for example, the Syrophoenician woman, that he was very keenly aware that he was very Jewish and he came to save the Jews first, but also then the Gentiles, and that he knew what it was like to be in the margins. He knew what it was like to be not quite fit in anywhere, to have that loneliness, to have that liminal existence. And so I think when we get back to our identity in the embodied mixed brown Christ, that's the third way. I think so often when people say your identity is in Christ, they have that in that non-embodied way. Your identity is in this ethereal spirit who loves us and wants us to all be nice.
Yes.
Right. And instead it's like, no, our identity is in Christ. That is my ultimate, top, most precious identity of all identities. But my identity is in a Jesus that walked the sands of the Middle East. My identity is in a Jesus who sat with women and loved them and honored them and called them to be not his main 12 disciples, but his disciples,
right.
to be a part of his church, to lead in his church. Mm-hmm. My identity is in a Jesus who had these foremothers who came and were grafted into the Jewish people as a taste of what was coming, of Gentiles being grafted into the people. And so, yeah, absolutely. Identity in Jesus. Identity in the real Jesus, not the floofy yeah. Jesus that yeah. unfortunately we allow to be preached.
That's so beautiful. I love that when we take a look at that picture of the real Jesus, that is what changes us. And because the floofy Jesus, yeah, it's so easy to fall into that mm-hmm, and wear mm-hmm. the cute t-shirts and, you know, all the things, but it's the real Jesus, the Jesus that asked the hard questions, mm-hmm. that turned the tables. The fact that he came as someone that was looked down upon,
mm-hmm. yeah.
he could have come in an easier fashion. It yeah. could have been easy and simple. He could have come as a rich king and ruler, but he chose to come and live in the margins and be among the people who were suffering. And that gives us such hope that he knows us and understands us, especially those of our brothers and sisters who are feeling like they don't fit, or they, you know, they struggle to find their identity. And so I just love that so much. I want to take a few minutes and talk to my listeners who maybe aren't mixed, that are like, mm-hmm. okay, this isn't for me. How do I, myself, my heritage is mostly German, and I, you know, but I also have a Black son. And so this affects me in a really big way because I'm constantly trying to learn how to best raise him mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. a place that he can discover his identity, because he has two white parents and what that looks like. And so let's speak to the woman listening that maybe looks more like me, that she's like, how do I love my friends who are struggling with that, that are mixed, and how do I just come alongside them and help them? What would you say?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I actually had a really fun conversation on Twitter. Shout out to Weird Evangelical Twitter, which
that's
I know Twitter can be a rough place, but man, Weird Evangelical Twitter, Weird Christian Twitter, so great.
It's so good.
So good. So a dear, dear brother, Kirk, he was commenting on how much he was sure that the book was a blessing to another brother, Robert, who is currently reading it. And so I you know, harassed him and said, thank mm-hmm. you so much. And now go get you one. And that's he said, I actually was wondering, can you give me your elevator pitch about why this pale white man should read it? And so it was really great. It was really helpful to get that summed up in my mind. And so mm-hmm. I said three things. I said, one, it's a chance to sit under the teaching of a mixed mm-hmm. person of color.
Absolutely.
And not just me even, but all of the stories mm-hmm. that are in the book.
Yeah.
Two, I did write it for mixed folks, you know, by mm-hmm. mixed folks. The podcast we have, Mixed Blessing Pod, mm-hmm. is by, for, and about multi-ethnic folks. But there's a lot to be learned for a person who wants to learn more about these things we're talking about. What it's like to be in liminal spaces, the in-between.
Yeah.
What it's like to be marginalized. What it's like mm-hmm. to, in that way, identify with the marginalized, right?
Yeah.
And also what it's like to be a bridge builder. What it's like to have that kind of knit into your DNA, into your upbringing, and how to do that well. Because I think there are so many people of color who are burning out, myself mm-hmm. included. You know, I just have to rely on Jesus day by day. This bridge building work is exhausting. And a lot of times people expect us to be the bridges. And I think that be the bridge, as Latasha Morrison does it, is beautiful and really well done. But I think we can take mm-hmm. out of that, I have to sacrifice myself. And it's like, no, Jesus is the bridge, right?
Yeah.
But there is something to be said for building bridges. And I think even a lot of majority culture, white folks, are burned out too.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much time spent bridge building that we're all just exhausted. And so I think there's something to be learned from mixed folks who don't have the option to necessarily walk away from bridge building, mm-hmm. but are finding, hopefully and prayerfully, ways to rest and to draw strength from the Lord. I think there's a lot to be learned from that. And third, I said that that a large part of, especially the last part of the book, is about how mixed people deserve to be empowered and equipped. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing it, my editor and my other good friend, who is mixed native white, Megan, were pushing me really hard. Like, don't write in addressing majority culture folks. Don't write in even addressing monoethnic minority folks, mm-hmm. right? So people who are fully, whatever that means, Asian, right. or, you know, whatever identify it yeah, who identify as Black and do not identify mm-hmm. as mixed. Just write to us, just write to mixed folks, which I found really freeing. But mm-hmm. in that, I'm coaching mixed folks, here's something you can say to monoethnic folks. Here's what we have a right to ask of monoethnic folks. So yeah. there's still stuff in there that a monoethnic person can read and say, oh, she's preaching to me, right?
Right.
She's equipping right. other mixed folks to say this type of thing to me. And I think that the empowering and the equipping part is so important, because often minorities of any kind, and you know, that can be ethnic minorities, that can be minorities in terms of socioeconomic status, in terms of gender, mm-hmm. right? I'm a minority often in a lot of spaces, but sometimes right. I'm a majority. You know, yeah. I have enough money and I have access to good healthcare, and right. you know, I'm not wrestling with certain other things that a lot of people are, right? So mm-hmm. I think it's really powerful for any majority culture person, any person who is in some place a majority, to listen to the minority and vice versa. I think that a lot of times when we ask minorities to speak and to lead, we don't empower and equip them first. So I think there can be this negative cycle of either we coddle minorities, mm-hmm. we don't empower them and equip them. We're like, oh, it's hard being you. And we just kind of coddle them and infantilize them mm-hmm. and don't empower and equip them to lead. Or on the opposite extreme, I think all too often we expect so much of minorities. Come teach us about how to be better and come lead us, but without the financial and emotional and other right. support mechanisms that minorities need to lead well. Mm-hmm. So the last part of the book is really a section of saying, okay, listen up, mixed folks, here's what we need and here's what we deserve. And here's how to ask the church for what we need and deserve. And here's how to tell the church, come to task and yeah. let's do this better. And so I think for those three reasons, you know, someone who is white, someone who is majority culture, someone who is monoethnically minority, someone who is not sure about any of this ethnic discussion, mm-hmm. even someone who is not a believer, I think can yeah. come to it and learn a lot. And then fourth, I said to my friend Kirk, and I said fourth, and support a fledgling author, you know,
that's right.
so go buy a coffee.
We need to buy our coffee and feed our kids.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Speaking of kids, how would you encourage parents to have some of these conversations with their children? I read a statistic recently in a book, I think it was by the year like 2040, 2050, that white will be the minority mm-hmm. in America, which is yeah. amazing.
Yeah.
I love that we are becoming such a, our culture is blending together and we are seeing more kids that are mixed. My kid's school is just so incredibly diverse and it's beautiful. How would you say, maybe specifically to white parents, mm-hmm. how can they have these conversations with their children to be able to accept and get to know their fellow classmates better?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was encouraged by someone to include in the back of the book a guide for parents. And so I included that. That's tricky, right? Because one of my answers though is it's a long conversation over a series of years, right? So
sure.
here's
it's
my,
not like a quick thing right. that it's done.
right. So here's my guide to ask some questions, but it's way harder than this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think as you well know, I'm sure, as with anything in parenting, it is a series of humbling mm-hmm. missteps and quiet, sweet moments and snuggles and asking questions and, mm-hmm. you know, listening really well, especially if you're a parent who has a majority culture privilege, you know, mm-hmm. compared to maybe a child who is mixed. But even then, right, even for those of us who are of the same ethnicity as our children, I mean, just to be a child, I think if the pandemic has taught me anything about parenting, just to be a child is such a vulnerable place, mm-hmm. right? Like, so, like right. I can barely comprehend and make sense of what happened a year ago. I can't imagine for my six-year-old baby. It's like she was in kindergarten and we picked her up from school one day and she never got to go back. And she never got to see any of her friends from her class that year. And she had to be home doing virtual school as a six-year-old. And God bless her, she did her best. And she, I'm so proud of her. But yeah, so all of these conversations about race and gender and sex and sexuality and, you know, economics and all of these things, mm-hmm. when we realize just how vulnerable and how much children need us and rely on us, in conjunction with, again, because I'm mixed, I refuse to just check one, I'm gonna check all that apply, in conjunction with, they're so much smarter and more resilient than we realize.
It's so true.
Jesus praised the heart of a child, right? Mm-hmm. We must be, have that childlike wonder and that childlike joy and that childlike dependence to enter the kingdom. Mm-hmm. I think when I'm at my best is when I have those things in mind and then I'm having these conversations with my kids. And especially after the murders in Atlanta, oh my goodness, so many sweet people checked in on us. So many sweet people, and especially so many wonderful Black folks, which just to me is beautiful and precious and humbling. One of our friends sent flowers to the three of us and just said, "For Chandra and Annabelle and Emmeline, I see you as the beautiful mixed women you are." And oh, just, it killed me. And of course the girls are like, these are beautiful. And our 11-year-old is like, what, why are you sad? And my 6-year-old is like, can I eat them? You know? So, I mean, kids.
Yes.
But we talked with our 11-year-old a little bit more about, you know, there was something awful that happened and it was specifically against Asians and Asian women. And so that, it's hard for mommy. That makes me sad and nervous and a little bit sick to my stomach for you, mm-hmm. being a young Asian woman. She's mixed, but she's still Asian. She still has Asian presenting features. Talked about it a little bit with the 6-year-old. You know, it's obviously it's an age appropriate thing. The 6-year-old mostly wants to know when the flower, who the flowers were from and when Auntie Bethany was going to come visit and, you know, that type of thing. I think the biggest thing for us in talking with our girls is asking them questions. And this really hits a lot of areas about how they feel about their bodies.
Yeah.
How they feel about the way they look, how people react to them. Mm. Of course, now that our 11-year-old is transitioning into puberty, you know, how's she feeling about her body? How do others respect or not respect her and her body? You know, how do they feel about having the shape of eyes that they have? Mm. Do people say anything about it at school? Do they have any questions about it? Here's how mom feels about her body and the shape of her eyes. And I think that is really humbling and really hard. And I really wish there were just easy answers, but there aren't. And then I think the other thing, right, that is very encouraging to me is that family of God, is all those aunties and uncles. We have wonderful, wonderful folks who, you know, some have lived with us and some are from church and some live across the country and some I've never even met in real life, who send gifts and who make themselves available for a phone call for our girls and who, you know, send books. And that makes all the difference, I think, because then realizing how overwhelmingly much we need to rely on the Lord, seeing that he has given us a family around us to help do that.
Yeah.
And knowing that, it, you know, prayerfully there won't come a point when my daughter and I aren't talking when she's a teenager, but there will be times, and I think this is okay and maybe even good, where she will be more comfortable calling up one of her aunties and talking with one of her aunties about something. And that's good.
Yeah.
That she will have another woman who loves Jesus, who represents the body of God in a different way even, that she can ask these tough questions of. And so I think that's my biggest encouragement is to parents, especially those who are trying to figure out how to love and raise and care well for their children who have some similarities, but also have some differences.
Right.
Like we're not meant to do it alone. Yeah. And one of my friends who is a white mom of black kids, her husband is black. She said, it is really humbling and really good for me to remember that I cannot be everything to my children.
Yeah.
I need to make sure that they have aunties who can teach them about their hair.
Mm-hmm.
That, man, what a blow against individualism, mm-hmm, and selfishness and the worship of the nuclear family.
Yeah.
Right? What a blow against Satan's devices to make us not see the family of God and not care about community. Like, you know what? Actually, this thing that I thought was a deficit in me is actually what God is using to remind me of how important the body is.
Isn't that the truth?
Right?
So much. Yeah. Because of the heaviness of things that are, you know, that are happening in our country with the shootings in Atlanta last week, would you just share a bit of maybe encouragement or how people, because I get lots of questions. Okay, what can I do? I get when there's racial tension and there's things like that, I'll have women reach out to me. What can I do? What do I do? What do I do? Would you share what does the Asian community need? How can the majority culture step into those spaces and love their neighbors around them?
So the quick, easy answer is all of the things that you would do for someone who's grieving for another reason, mm-hmm, right? You bring a meal.
Yeah.
In this day and age, you know, you DoorDash something, you Venmo.
That's right.
I had a friend who I've never met on Twitter, God bless Canadians, who is part of that weird Christian Twitter, mm-hmm, family, who PayPal'd me $5 for coffee.
Yeah.
Like, just you do that, right? You do those little things. You also do it, and this is where it gets kind of in the more tricky part, you do it without expectation of acknowledgement or even interaction.
Yeah.
And I think that's the hard part. There was another, I referenced Twitter a whole lot. I don't know. It is what it is. I was part of another interesting conversation where someone was saying, please stop texting me. And it was for other issues. Like, please stop texting me. Please stop asking how I'm doing. And I think in large part, it's where she's at in her grieving process.
Right.
But also it's this sense of like, and this is what I tweeted, maybe if you are texting an acquaintance to say, how are you doing? And they don't respond, it's because you're just an acquaintance and they don't owe you anything.
Right.
And that doesn't diminish the kindness of you wanting to reach out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's best to reach out in ways that don't require interaction.
Yes.
Especially if it's not someone. Now, look, if it's someone that you are very, very close to and they don't respond to you, maybe there's mental health issues, mm-hmm, and you do need to push into that. And maybe they're having suicidal ideation,
right,
and, you know, and you're one of the people that God has called to be like, no, I'm coming to your house,
yeah,
and I'm sitting 6 feet away and I'm giving you a casserole and I'm not going to bother you, but I'm here.
Yeah.
Right. But for that like weird acquaintance spot, mm-hmm, and I think this is the answer none of us want to hear. Sometimes all you can do is grieve,
mm-hmm,
and mourn and listen.
Yeah.
And that's really uncomfortable because we want to know what we can do.
Right.
And I think that's part of the difficulty in all of these conversations surrounding majority and minority culture. Mm-hmm. And again, in the places where I'm the majority, I don't want to just sit and listen.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go.
I want to fix
something.
It. Like I
want
to. I just want it to be done because I feel like, exactly, as the majority, a lot of times we feel like, well, we can fix it. We have this ability to fix it, but not even fully understanding what is truly going on.
Right, right. And I think we have to be willing to sit in the ashes with people first. Job's friends didn't go wrong.
I was literally about to say the same thing.
Until they opened their big mouths.
That's right.
Sitting in the ashes was great. And even, I think it's interesting, even Job's wife, her problem wasn't that she spoke up. Her problem is that she gave up.
Yeah.
Right. Her words to Job weren't even, you deserve this,
yeah,
so much as God clearly has given up on you. You should give up on him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Job's faithfulness was in saying, no way.
Yeah.
I will cling to this God that I'm very, very mad at,
mm-hmm,
until he does something. So yeah, so listening is hard, but I think it's good. And to put more of a, not a comfortable bow on it, but to put more hope on
it,
right? It is when we sit in those ashes, if we keep sitting in them, eventually God does show up.
That's right.
And eventually we have hope. And Jesus himself, he died on the cross. We're in Lent right now. That's awful and painful. And only if we can sit with that, mm-hmm, can we get to Easter?
That's right.
So, you know, when someone is wanting to help, sit some more and listen some more and wait on God to tell you. And when God tells you, go do it.
That's right.
He will. Easter comes eventually, but we have to be willing to sit through Good Friday and through Holy Saturday to know what Easter can actually look like.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. This has been such an encouragement to me. Will you tell all my listeners where they can find you, where they can follow you on Twitter, where they can get your book, all the things?
Yes, please. Thank you. Yes. So Twitter is my go-to for interactions. It's at Chandra L, which stands for Louise Crane. And yeah, I'd love to chat with people on there. We have some great, great conversations. And I also tweet a lot of ridiculous things about my kids. So you can get everything there. You can get the silliness and the seriousness all wrapped in one, which, as I tweeted recently, that's what the marginalized do, right? That's how we survive.
That's right.
We laugh and we cry at the same time.
Absolutely.
I'm also on Instagram at Chandra L. Crane or at Mixed Blessing Book. If you go to ivypress.com, mixed-blessing, you can get that book and you can actually save 30% now if you use the code MIX30.
Awesome.
So as a thank you to listeners of the Mixed Blessing podcast and of your podcast,
great,
Kara Kay. Yeah. And I would love for people to come find me. And I have a website, chandracrane.com. So
perfect.
Come find me. We'll chat. It'll be awesome.
Love it. Well, I'm putting links to everything in the show notes today, guys. So you can go grab the book and follow and learn, because that is one of the most important things we can do, is learn and listen. So thank you so much for your voice, for your book, and just for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for using your platform. I really appreciate it.
I'm Kara K. James, and you've just listened to the Asking for a Friend podcast. I hope you are inspired and encouraged by these conversations to step out of the status quo and engage in conversations that matter. You can find the show notes for this episode and subscribe at karakjames.com/podcast. I also love connecting with you on Instagram and Facebook. I am at karak.james. You can also subscribe to my newsletter at karakjames.com/newsletter. This podcast is meant to provide you with a safe space to work through the questions you have about yourself, the church, and the world around you. Please never hesitate to reach out to me if you need a safe place to land. Thanks for listening, and keep asking questions for a friend.